now ask you then to give our speaker your earnest and undivided attention whilst he speaks on the subject, the Middle East problem.
So the subject then is the Middle East problem. And I've sort of put problem in inverted commas because it might not be such a problem as people think, or it might be the result or the way it's going to be solved is going to be probably very, very different to the way that most people consider. So first of all, what exactly is meant by the Middle East problem? Well, if you sort of ask people what they mean by the Middle East problem, it's quite a common phrase. Here's what people generally understand by the Middle East problem. Obviously, there's an intractable, very difficult to solve peace problem in the Middle East. It's very difficult to solve that lack of peace. And actually, the belief is that the lack of peace in the Middle East is the primary or the sort of root cause of all the instability and terrorism around the world. And so the sort of logic goes that if we can only solve the Middle East problem, you will enter an age of peace when, you know, for example, terrorism won't happen anymore and all the problems of the Middle East won't kind of spill over onto the rest of the world. Therefore, creating peace in the Middle East is kind of what the world believes that we should be doing. And therefore, it follows that if there's going to be peace everywhere else, if there is peace in the Middle East, then it naturally follows that kind of imposing peace in the Middle East would be a good idea. Just to give you an idea of how complex the Middle East problem is, it's a little bit like a sort of Gordian knot and trying to untangle it all and trying to find out who hates who and who likes who is really complex. There's lots of different people and nationalities and so on that are all intermingled in a really, really complicated way, which is why peace in the Middle East has been so intractable. For example, there are Shiites versus Sunni Muslims. Shiites are the more traditional, you might say, and tend to be the ones that the West would regard as fanatics, whereas Sunni Muslims, supposedly, are more kind of, maybe not quite as extreme, you might say, not quite as fundamental. Then you've got the problem of Arabs versus non-Arabs. So, whereas you might think the Middle East as being Arabs, that's not necessarily universally true. For example, Turkey aren't Arabs at all. Iran aren't Arabs. Pakistan and sort of Afghanistan, not necessarily in the Middle East as such, but they're not Arabs either. And the Arab nations are ethnically diverse. There's quite a complex kind of ethnic makeup there. And all the Arab countries, they're not all that close necessarily. So there's a problem, if you like, with Arabs and non-Arabs, where they don't necessarily trust each other. There's also huge sets of problems in the Middle East with corruption and the wealth inequalities, and just seriously impoverishment. So it's interesting that the people generally in the Middle East are extremely poor, and yet very often at the top end of the scale, you have people who are basically the world's wealthiest, where the wealth almost can't be measured anymore, and they have lots more wealth coming in. So in the Middle East, there's a huge difference between the poor people at the bottom and the rich people at the top. The Middle East also has lots of problems with Christians versus Muslims. So for example, there are quite a large amount of Christian Arabs, as opposed to the majority Muslim Arabs. And there's also lots of little sects in the middle, where there's, for example, Alawi sects in Syria. And there's lots of sects in the Middle East that aren't easy to define. Also, there's problems, whichever way you want to put it politely, with Palestinians in the Middle East. It's not just Israel that has problems with Palestinians. Every other country does as well. So, for example, in Jordan, even though the state of Jordan was formed specifically for Palestinians, the Palestinians actually caused a civil war in Jordan in the 80s, and it almost led to the country being taken over. King Hussein of Jordan expelled them, and the Palestinians then went to Lebanon, And within about 2 or 3 years of landing on the shores of Lebanon, there was then civil war in Lebanon caused by Palestinians. And generally, other Arabs don't trust or like the Palestinians for quite a complex set of reasons, which I won't go into. There's also problems in the Middle East, with Gaza and the West Bank, where, depending who you listen to, it's either whether one, I think everyone agrees they're occupied. The question is more, are they occupied by the people who should occupy them? Even though Israel isn't in Gaza and the West Bank as such anymore, the BBC News, for example, keeps on referring to Gaza as being occupied. It's occupied by people who live there, but Israel withdrew the occupied territories. There's also quite significant problems with Hezbollah in the Middle East, where Hezbollah, the name means party of Allah or party of God, so that gives you an indication of what they perceive themselves to be. They perceive themselves to be kind of jihadists on God's behalf. So you might call them terrorists if you were inclined, or freedom fighters if you weren't inclined. The Hezbollah themselves are extremely complicated makeup, and they just want to impose their own version of peace in the Middle East. There's also significant problems with Hamas and Fatah. Fatah is the sort of wing of the Palestinians, which Yasser Arafat, all those years ago before he died, he was the sort of leader of Fatah. And Hamas are the other group of Palestinians who are fanatically against Yasser Arafat's lot. Hamas in Hebrew, interestingly, means violence. And it's, although it's an acronym in Arabic, it's probably no coincidence that it does mean violence in Arabic, because that's what we want to do to Jews. Even apart from all that, in the Middle East there's also disputed land. So for example, Sinai, maybe not all that disputed, but it was disputed years ago. It's now technically owned by Egypt. It was meant to be a buffer zone where neither Egypt nor Israel would militarise it. But of course, that promise was broken years ago, and now Egyptians are militarising it. The Golan as well, Golan Heights, used to belong to Syria, well, it used to belong to Israel, but then last century Syria had it, and it was taken from them through war, when they declared war in Israel, and so now Israel has the Golan Heights. Syria wants it back, and that's again another very complex set of problems in the Middle East. I think everyone agrees the Middle East is occupied, but the term occupied territories is often used to mean that Jews are in the Middle East. Jews are in the land of Israel, and people mean that Jews shouldn't be in the land of Israel. So there's a huge number of extremely complex problems that actually aren't necessarily anything to do with Israel, but all these different factions and groups and beliefs are all, you know, stabbing each other in the back, etc. And those problems are leading to tension worldwide. And those problems are problems in the Middle East are being kind of exported, if you like, elsewhere. And so going back to the previous slide, this is an extremely complex and tractable lack of peace in the Middle East. And it's that lack of peace that people feel, that instability, the tensions, the factions fighting each other, that people believe lead to terrorism around the world. And so if we can solve the Middle East problems, or let's say impose a solution on them, then all those problems will simply disappear and the rest of the world can get on happily with their lives. So how do we solve the Middle East problems? We've seen what the Middle East problem is, but how do we enforce it? Well, actually, if you start to scratch the surface, it would be, you know, millions of years of talks trying to explain how you would do it. But if you get to the bottom of what people actually mean, what you find, if you ask each of those groups individually, what do you think needs to be done to solve the Middle East problem? In fact, what you find is actually the solution is remarkably simple in just about everyone's eyes, including everyone outside the Middle East for the most part. Basically, the world is deeply, inherently anti-Semitic. It always has been anti-Semitic, and almost certainly, probably, always will be. Inevitably, the world and all the participants in the Middle East, apart from Israel itself, blames the Jews, ultimately, for causing all the problems. And Israel, or the Jews, are seen really by every other antagonist as being the stumbling block to world peace. In an age of democracy and peace and harmony and lack of terrorism, etc. In other words, if you go back to all those different participants and just systematically one by one ask them, how do you think you would solve the Middle East problem? It doesn't matter whether they're Hezbollah, Fatah, whatever, they all will agree that getting rid of Israel is the solution to all their problems. And so the theory goes that basically, it doesn't matter how complex the problem is, who's involved, whether it's this party or that party, or this country or that party, or Arabs or Jews or Christians or whatever, the world believes, and all the participants in the Middle East, for the most part, believe that you can solve the Middle East problem by one of two methods, or in fact both methods for that matter. One is by forcing Israel to give up land, so that has been attempted with Sinai, Golan, the West Bank, Gaza, just systematically giving up more and more of Israel, or even simpler still, is simply to destroy Israel off the face of the map. And that is the declared intention of numerous countries in the Middle East, such as Iran. Iran is over decades now, just decades and decades, leader after leader, has always said, you know, we are going to destroy Israel off the face of the map. That's their main intention of getting a nuclear weapon, for example. They're openly admitting that they want to get a nuclear weapon to wipe Israel off the face of the map. But not the first, that was what Saddam Hussein also wanted to do. That's what the Palestinians have always striven to do. It's what Fatah and Hamas and Hezbollah, their sole purpose in being formed, was to destroy Israel. And, you know, as would Syria, etc., as would nearly every country in the Middle East. So, essentially, every country in the Middle East, and for the most part of the world, the West in particular, believes that the solution is to destroy Israel, just genocide against one particular people. So rather than trying to disentangle the process of how to solve the Middle East process, you can kind of save time a little by not dissecting the logic, the faulty logic behind all those ideas, but simply looking at what people are actually going to do. Because this is actually spoken of in the Bible. The Bible itself explicitly says what people are going to do in the latter days. They're going to gather all nations together, are going to systematically gather against the land of Israel, against Jerusalem, against God's heritage, and they're going to impose peace, and they're going to try to solve the Middle East problem their way. Let's just look at a few verses that show us what's going to happen. Because what we've said before about what the world and for the most part, the protagonists in the Middle East believe is exactly what they're going to do, exactly what the scriptures are going to teach. And this is going to be a time of trouble such as never was. So if you look at a few of the prophets, for example, if you go to Joel chapter 3, Joel in chapter 3 in the first few verses. It says, "For behold, in those days and at that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat and plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land." It says, "I will gather all nations and bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat." So this is speaking of that very event that I've just mentioned, that all nations are going to decide that simply wiping off Israel off the face of the map is going to be what they regard as the solution to all the problems. In verse 3, "And they have cast lots for my people, and have given a boy to an harlot and sold a girl for wine that they might drink." You go to verse 9 of that same chapter. "Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles, or the nations, prepare war. Wake up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, and gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Yahweh. Let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about." So all nations are going to gather against God's people to basically destroy them. The intention is to have one huge genocide for once and all, get rid of Israel, and then the rest of us can now live in peace and harmony. It's an extremely extreme choice of solution when simply eradicating one side from the conflict is your supposed answer. But that has happened before. For example, Haman in the Book of Esther wanted to destroy all Jews. Adolf Hitler wanted to destroy all Jews. So it's happened in the past several times, and if it's happened in the past, it will happen again. If we go to Zephaniah, that's the third or fourth last prophet in the Old Testament, Zephaniah and chapter 3 and verse 8. And again talks about gathering all nations together. Therefore awake ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations, that they may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. If you go to that chapter of Zechariah which we just read, and just look at a few verses from that. Zechariah chapter 12 and verses 2 to 3. It says, behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in a siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. So again, it's another verse that talks about all the nations of the earth being gathered against Jerusalem and against God's people. Just turn over the chapter to chapter 14 and verse 2. And you can see the scale of this. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women raped, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. So it's a huge carnage when all the nations gather against Israel to battle to solve, inverted commas, the Middle East problem, in inverted commas. So if you go to the last day, Ezekiel, in chapter 38, again you see the nations that are gathering explicitly mentioned there. Ezekiel 38 and verse 2. Son of man, set thy face against Gog in the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against them, and say, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armour, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords, Persia, Ethiopia, Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his bands, the house of Tagarma of the north quarters and all his bands, and many people with thee. And so it's talking about a huge northern confederacy of nations against Israel. And if you look at who those nations are, there isn't really time to go into it in detail here, but it's what you might call the usual suspects in the war on terrorism. There's Iran, there's Ethiopia, and Sudan, Libya, all those terrorist nations of the past. There's also, interestingly, if you look at the historical derivation of those nations, there's also Europe. Europe's an inherently anti-Semitic set of nations, and France and Germany in particular are represented there, as are Russia, you know, Gog, Moscow, Russia, all those names, if you start looking at where they've arrived from, that's where they are. There's a huge northern confederacy of nations gathered against Jerusalem and Israel to battle. So that, unfortunately, is how the world is going to attempt to solve the Middle East problem. In other words, just for once and all to come against the land of Israel and God's people, simply wipe them all out, and thereby they believe they will peace will then be able to happen in the rest of the world. It's almost as if they're going to give God's people as a sacrifice so that they can have peace. However, I would suggest that there is just one problem with that, and that is that God isn't going to simply allow that to happen. There's a verse in Zechariah chapter 2 and verse 8 which we'll just read. It says, "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you." In other words, that's all those nations that have come against Israel. "For he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye." And if we just look again, go back to Zechariah and just see, having read those verses about the nations gathering against Israel, just look at the next verse specifically in those chapters. So Zechariah chapter 12, and we've read how all the nations are going to come against Israel to battle. But in verse 9, we didn't read the next verse, but it says, "And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem." So God will destroy those nations who have come against Israel. Or if we turn to Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 3, it says, you know, having read about all nations gathering against Jerusalem to battle, it says, "Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle." This is going to be a huge battle, and all the nations gathering together to fight against Israel, but God and the saints and the angels then fighting back to defend God's people. Israel is God's land. The Jews are God's people. The world, you know, all those nations that came against Israel, they're going to find out that they've made a terrible, terrible mistake simply because they didn't believe in God. And to understand why that's going to be a mistake and why God's people will never be destroyed, we need to take a little detour, if you like, and just look at the nation of Israel and the Jewish people. We'll find that this nation are unlike any other nation in the past. They survived longer, and they're going to survive longer. Let's just take a look at a phrase, the immortal Jew. This was coined, if you like, by Mark Twain when he was writing in Harper's Magazine in 1899. That's to say, Mark Twain has wrote, you know, Huckleberry Finn and Adventures of Tom Sawyer, so he's quite a well-known writer. But just read what he says. He correctly understood that the Jews won't be destroyed. You know, they've managed to survive down through the centuries, down through the millennia, and they're not going to be destroyed by a coalition of people, no matter how well-intentioned they are, and no matter how numerous they are. So Mark Twain said, "If statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. It suggests a nebulous, dim puff of stardust, lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jews ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of, has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has always made a marvellous fight in the world in all the ages, and he has done it without his hands tied, with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, and then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now, or have vanished. The Jews saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?" Well, the secret of his immortality is that God is behind them. They're God's people. They are the apple of God's eyes. And so the nations that come against Israel will be destroyed. So what's meant by an immortal Jew? How can Jews be immortal? Well, if you look at their history, it seems as though Jews have always existed, have never died, and indeed they can't die. For example, they've been around as a people, well, since Moses in 1450 BC, but as a distinct people before that. So they're more than 3,500 years old. They're still a distinct, recognisable people. Hebrew is still the national language that they've always spoken. They're still, even now, in the land of Israel. And just think of the list of nations that the Jews have outlived. these entire empires that they've outlived. The ancient Egyptians with their pyramids, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, closer to home the Celts, further afield the Incas, the Aztecs, closer to home in Israel the Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites. These are entire nations, entire cultures have come and gone, entire world empires have come and gone. The Romans, for example, and the Greeks, and yet the Jews have outlived them all, seen them all out, and are still recognisable today. Still in the land of Israel, still speaking Hebrew, and still distinctly apart from other nations. It defies all logic, it defies all sense of explanation. The Jews are in fact a 3,500 year miracle of survival. Let's just think about a few things that have happened in that bizarre and miraculous length of time. Here's just a few verses I'll read from you from Jeremiah, which will just put things into context. Jeremiah chapter 31 and verses 35 to 37. Thus saith the Lord, which giveth the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon and of the stars for a light by night, which divideth the sea when the waves thereof roar, the Lord of hosts is his name. If those ordinances depart from before me, saith the Lord, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. For thus saith the Lord, if heaven above can be measured, and the foundations of the earth stretched out beneath, I will also cast up all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith the Lord. To put it into more simple language, there's about as much chance of the Jews not being God's people and of being destroyed as the sun falling out of the sky or the moon not giving any light. It's impossible, it's not going to happen. So just to show you what Jews have done, to survive the 10 devastating plagues that almost wiped out Egypt as an empire, to survive nations attacked by nations much, much mightier and stronger and more numerous themselves, such as the Philistines, the Hivites, Perizzites, Jebusites, etc. They survived onslaughts from the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians. They were taken into exile by the Babylonians in AD 587, and they came back into the land of Israel. They were taken into captivity by the Romans in AD 70, and yet they've come back to survive. They're expelled from Jerusalem, completely expelled, under Hadrian, where he built his new capital. And yet the Jews came back. They were scattered across the whole Roman Empire, sold as slaves in Alexandria, Egypt, and yet the Jews have come back to their land. The Crusade started off with killing Jews wholesale across Europe, and yet it's the Crusaders that have ended now, and Jews have still come back to the land of Israel. There's been systematic expulsions from Europe, for example, from 1000 to 1500 AD, roughly, across England and Wales, across all the nations of Europe, Jews were systematically expelled by the kings and queens. It was 1296 in England and Wales. It was 1492 in Spain, the very day that Christopher Columbus set sail, when some Jews were formally expelled from Spain. Portugal, 1497, France, 1182, and Germany, there's been just lots and lots of expulsions. The Jews in Europe were heavily persecuted from 1937 to 1941 under the Holocaust, when the Nazis systematically wanted to eradicate them. So Jews have been expelled from Jerusalem in AD 70, for example, and yet still have come back to the land of Israel. Jews have been systematically persecuted, burnt, killed during the Crusades, for example. The Crusaders, as they went to Jerusalem and the Holy Land, they left a path of death and destruction behind in all the Jewish communities as they went. You know, why would they go all the way over to unbelievers in the Holy Land to kill them when we can just kill Jews right here at home? The Jews are also blamed for the Black Death in the Middle Ages. If you look at Jewish persecution and expulsion across Europe, you know, systematically, nation after nation has hated the Jews so much that they've systematically expelled them, completely independently from all the different possible countries. It's not that far away in recent memory when the Jews were persecuted under the Nazis, where there was just something like 6 million Jews systematically eradicated, and it was very systematic the way the Germans did that. They wanted to make sure that no stone was left unturned that every single person who was accused of being a Jew would be killed. And despite, you know, near extermination, it's Hitler and it's the Nazi Empire that died, and Jews have survived and lived on. So if you look at the mystery of the immortal Jew, and just consider the amazing things that have happened, they've retained a distinct national or religious identity all down through the century, actually down through thousands of years, not just hundreds of years. They've become a byword, a proverb. They've been systematically persecuted as they've gone along down through the centuries in different countries independently. And yet, despite serious and systematic persecutions, they've never been wiped out as a people or nation. In fact, it's the other way around. It's all their enemies that have systematically gone down to the grave. You know, Haman, Hitler, and all the other people. They've been scattered to all the four corners of the earth, and yet gathered back again. They've formed their own nation again, in their own land, speaking their own language, Hebrew, and reading God's word. All this, of course, has been prophesied beforehand, because the Jews are God's people. Let's just look at Isaiah 43. This tells us that God is using the Jewish people as a means to show that he exists, because they defy all explanation otherwise. Isaiah chapter 43 and verse 9. It says, "Let all the nations be gathered together, and let the people be assembled. Who among them can declare this and show us former things? Let them bring forth their witnesses that they may be justified, or let them hear and say it is true." The Jewish people prove that God exists, because all those things have been written beforehand. For example, it's a miracle that these things have happened at all. By any logic or explanation, the Jewish people should not exist as an independent people by now. It's not just coincidence, there's a reason for this. But God's hand is at work here. The verse in Isaiah says that no one could declare all this before it happened. He couldn't predict it, so marvellous. And yet the scriptures do predict all this in great detail. So I'll just turn very briefly to Deuteronomy chapter 28. This is a long chapter, but it's extremely precise in the things which it says. And all those persecutions that you've read about, they're all predicted thousands of years in advance before they happen, as evidence that God exists and that God is using the Jewish people, because they are the apple of his eye, as that verse that we saw earlier from the prophet. So Deuteronomy chapter 28, it would be nice to read the whole chapter, but there isn't time. But for example, if you go to verse 15, it starts to show some of the cursings that would happen. "But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee." And those curses continue in column after column of the Bible, for two or three pages, right down to the very end of the chapter, in verse 6 to 8. There's almost, you know, 60 odd verses with very specific things that would happen to them. Let's just look at a few of them. So in verse 36, "The Lord shall bring thee, and thy king, which thou shalt set over thee." So the Jews haven't even gone into the land yet, and yet God is saying in this chapter that you're going to set up a king unto a nation which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, and there thou shalt serve other gods, wood and stone. This is all the, for example, the Babylonian exile and the Syrian exile. In verse 37, "And thou shalt become an astonishment, a proverb, and a byword among all nations, whither the Lord shall lead thee." And every single nation has words in their language for, you know, nicknames for the Jews. They're known as being a distinct people. In verse 53, "And thou shalt eat the fruit of thine own body, the flesh of thy sons and of thy daughters, which the Lord thy God hath given thee, in the siege and in the straitness wherewith thine enemies shall distress thee." In Josephus, it talks about some of the cannibalism that went on in the siege by the Romans against Jerusalem. In verse 62, "And you shall be left few in number." So just imagine the persecution of the Nazis, for example, where 6 million Jews were systematically wiped out. "And you shall be few in number, whereas you were as the stars of heaven for multitudes, because thou wouldest not obey the voice of the Lord thy God." In verse 64, "And the Lord shall scatter thee among all people." So the Jews were scattered. In AD 70 they were scattered even worse than under Hadrian, from one end of the earth even unto the other. And there thou shalt serve other gods, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And verse 65, and among those nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the solitary foot of rest, but the Lord shall give thee there a trembling heart, and failing of eyes, and sorrow of mind, and thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shalt have none assurance of thy life. In the morning thou shalt say, Would God it were even, and at even thou shalt say, Would God it were morning, for the fear of thine heart wherewith thou shalt fear, and for the sight of thine eyes which thou shalt see. All those have been systematic persecutions. If you read books about the Holocaust and the things that happened, such as, you know, the Diary of Anne Frank, they were just living in terror of when the Nazis were going to come and find them. But also the Jews were sold into slavery around the world. So all these things are explicitly prophesied off beforehand. That's not the end of the story. There's another remarkable thing that happened more or less in their own sort of lifetime. Let's just look at some of the events that of more recent times where the Jewish people have been brought back to the land again, because already there's miracles happening. There's things happening that can only be described as miracles because they've never happened before in order to get the Jews to come back to the land. So for example, under the Rothschild dynasty, Edmund the Rothschild, 1845 to 1934, became fabulously rich, richer than you can even really contemplate nowadays. We talk about someone who's a millionaire being rich. A million dollars or £1 million is almost an incredible amount of money. But a billionaire is 1,000 times a millionaire. A billionaire is someone who's 1,000 times a millionaire. And there are not many billionaires in this world today. There might be Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, etc. And they might have a few tens of billions in money that's kind of skimmed off for decades. But Edmund the Rothschild, his wealth was probably uncountable. In today's terms, it was reckoned to be something like a multi-trillionaire. That's 1,000 times a billionaire. A millionaire is somebody who's rich, but a trillionaire is 1,000,000 times richer than a millionaire. It's like if he took all the wealth from all the millionaires around the whole world, that was his personal wealth. But he helped the land of Israel and Zionism in those early days. He had an almost incomprehensible amount of money and influence, and that was almost what set off Zionism. He single-handedly managed to finance a lot of the early industries. So for example, he helped to set up the kibbutzes or settlements. He paid money to have malarial swamps drained. He set up lots of businesses, such as the Rothschild vineyards and Israel's whole wine industry. The glass and bottle making factories in Israel. His son established the Knesset. He's estimated to have spent something like $50 million in the land of Israel, which was an immense sum in those days. For one person to do that now, but bear in mind this was, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, or 150 years ago, inflation means that that sum is almost incomprehensible nowadays. So for somebody to be that wealthy who happens to like Israel is never happened before. It's reckoned that no one really ever could be that wealthy again. But if you look at, for example, the way in which when Israel did come back to the land under Zionism, at that time there just happened to be someone, again this is something that's never happened before, who was able to re-kickstart the Hebrew language, to recreate a language for modern times and to coalesce people into speaking that language. Has never happened before in one person's lifetime. Eliezer ben Yehuda had a huge knowledge of Hebrew. He studied Hebrew, obviously he was a Jew, but he studied Hebrew all down through the centuries, from the Hebrew Bible, Talmud, the Mishnah, Rabbinical Hebrew, etc., hundreds of years of medieval Hebrew, and he was able to kind of kickstart the Hebrew language. But when Zionists went back into the land, he was able to coalesce them to get them to understand Hebrew again, and to start speaking Hebrew. And it worked, and the Jews now speak Hebrew in the land of Israel. It would be great if the Welsh, the Scots and the Cornish people would love their languages to be resurrected again. But languages over time just die out when they're a minority language. So Eliezer ben Yehuda managed to reverse that trend. This is something that's never happened in history before, just as the wealth of the Rothschilds has never happened before. And for a state to be formed again, all the events around the 1948 State of Israel being formed, just as there was favourable people around the world who would finance it, just as the Rothschild wealth was still happening, just as Eliezer Ben Yehuda forming Israel again, a state was formed and, you know, under miraculous circumstances. A people never before in human history have been scattered for 2,000 years and then regathered to their original happened, the original land. It just never happened. 1947 mandate was both Israel and Jordan together. And if the Jews had returned, they would have had far more land than they have now. And the Holocaust that we've spoken about ends up driving Jews back to the land of Israel. Israel was then, you know, systematically attacked by seven nations around them. They were, you know, defeated those nations in the 1967-60 war, and the 1973 Yom Kippur war. And it's never really happened, apart from Israel's own history, where they've been systematically attacked by seven other nations who completely outnumbered them, and yet they've managed to survive. So the Middle East problem, going back to the title, the world thinks the problem is that Jews are in the Middle East, and by getting Jews not to be in the Middle East, by simply gathering themselves against them to eradicate them, the world thinks that that's how they can solve the Middle East problem. And so God will shortly gather all those nations against Israel to battle. Just summarising the verses we've seen, there's Joel, and he says, I will gather all nations and bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. And Zephaniah, therefore wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to my praise. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger. For all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. And Zechariah, there's other verses as well, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Those verses also go on to say that Israel will recognize the Messiah. That despite all those nations coming against Israel, Israel will just about be destroyed, that they will, through all that, recognize their Messiah. Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 7, the Lord also shall save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. Verse 8, 9 and 10, in that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them at that day shall be as David, and the house of David shall be as God and as the angel of the Lord before them. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, and they shall look upon me whom they have feared, and they shall mourn for him, as one that mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him, as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. And so God will destroy those nations that come against Israel. Those nations thought that they were going to destroy God's people and God's heritage, but all they've really done is come against the apple of God's eye. God will protect his people when that happens. Just as the Jewish people have never been wiped out, even though there's been many attempts, just as they are, you know, a miracle of salvation down through the millennium, this will happen again, and God will once again rise to defeat his people. Just to read through a few of those verses finally, just to show you just how complete that destruction will be. If you turn to Zechariah chapter 12, and this is mostly just reading the next few verses, when we read about those nations coming against Israel to battle. So Zechariah chapter 12 and the next few verses. Verse 3, and in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, so all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. In that day, saith the Lord, I will smite every horse with astonishment, and its rider with madness, and I will open mine eyes upon the house of Judah, and will smite every horse of the people with blindness. If we go to verse 9, in that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them at that day shall be as David, and the house of David shall be as God, as the angel of the Lord before them. If we turn to chapter 14 of Zechariah, and look at verses 3 and 4. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west. And there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. And just lastly, if you go to Ezekiel and chapter 38, and just read a few of the verses that talk about the destruction of the nations who have come against Israel to battle. Ezekiel chapter 38, just reading from verse 18. And it shall come to pass at the same time when Gog shall come against the land of Israel, saith the Lord God, that my fury shall come up in my face. For in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken. Surely in that day there shall be a very great shaking in the land of Israel, so that the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the heaven and all the beasts of the field and all creeping things that creep upon the earth and all the men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence, and the mountains shall be thrown down, and the steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. And I will call for a sword against them, strike all my mountains, saith the Lord God. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. He goes on to talk about the tremendous destruction in that day. Just going on to the next few verses in chapter 39. And in verse 2, and I will turn thee back and leave thee but the sixth part of thee, and will cause thee to come up before the north part, and shall bring thee upon the mountains of Israel. And I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand, and will cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. Thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands, and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous birds of every sort, and to the beasts of the field to be devoured. And so that's the destruction that will come against God's people. So people in the world and nations are looking for a solution to the Middle East problem. That solution will come. Peace will come throughout all the nations of the earth, except that it won't come by man's hand. It won't come through the nations gathering themselves against Jerusalem to wipe out God's people. But it will return by that happening, and that sparking off the return of Christ and the establishment of the kingdom of God. It's worth reminding us of Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17, where it says, this matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the Holy Ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High willeth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of men. In other words, God in heaven is ruling over the kingdom of men. He's going to take the kingdom of men away from these wicked rulers, and he's going to give it to those who are righteous in that day, to his saints, to those who have searched scriptures daily to find out what these things mean. You might think that God isn't ruling just now, but the angels are watching down on the kingdom of men. They know what the kingdom of men is going to do. They know how the nations are going to try to attempt to solve the Middle East problem, and it's going to go very, very badly wrong for them. But until that happens, it would be worth just remembering Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17. This matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the Holy Ones, to intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the faces of men. And these events will surely come to pass, and will come to pass very quickly. Things can happen very, very quickly indeed, and all God's people, all the nations that come against God's people, will end up being destroyed and buried in the mountains of Israel.